Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Good morning, everyone. If you took the weekend off from news for Passover and Easter, here's something you might want to know. The ideological unraveling of Donald Trump is continuing day by day. Trump voters, are you confused yet? Who remembers during the campaign when Jeb Bush said the federal government was overfunding women's health? And Trump went on MSNBC and said this.
You know, the women's health issue, which Jeb Bush so amazingly blew about 4 or 5 days ago when he said no money going to women's health issues, or essentially that. And with me, Mika, I would be the best for women, the best for women's health issues.
Donald Trump with Mika Brzezinski on MSNBC back then, and thanks to Charles Blow in his New York Times column for reminding us of that soundbite. On Thursday, as the media were focusing on Syria, North Korea, Passover, and Easter, Trump signed a bill that allows states to defund Planned Parenthood and other women's health clinics, even if they do not perform abortions at those particular facilities. If Ivanka Trump was not complicit, she was at the very least publicly silent. Also, as you know, Trump attacked Syria with 59 missiles after saying repeatedly he would not interfere with dictators who were fighting ISIS or who support the United States in any way. He downgraded the status of Steve Bannon, the America First nationalist who promoted that kind of military restraint in the interest of spending American money on American workers. And in the latest downgrade of American workers' interests in favor of global superpower interests, Trump has now flipped his position on labeling China a currency manipulator because of China's involvement in containing North Korea. Trump tweeted yesterday, "Why would I label China a currency manipulator when they're working with us on the North Korea problem?" The art of the deal, I guess, and the art of learning about the world when all you've been is a businessman. The government rookie president said this about North Korea after meeting with China's president Xi Jinping recently, quote, "After listening for 10 minutes, I realized it's not so easy. It's not what you would think," he told the Wall Street Journal. I guess Trump never stopped to listen for 10 minutes before, which was reminiscent of when Trump said this just before his health care bill failed in Congress.
"Now, I have to tell you, it's an unbelievably complex subject. Nobody knew that health care could be so complicated."
Trump's relationship status with his former beliefs, it's complicated. Or at least they were his formerly stated beliefs. Political analysts are saying all he wants now is some wins. For now, he's finding those wins on the battlefields of Syria and Afghanistan. With me first today is New York Times national security correspondent David Sanger. His Page One news analysis is called "A Cuban Missile Crisis in Slow Motion in North Korea." Thanks for coming on, David. Welcome back to WNYC.
Great to be back with you.
And we'll get to North Korea as Cuban Missile Crisis in slow motion. But how flabbergasted is anyone, as far as you could tell, by yesterday's tweet stating flat out that Trump is dealing away leverage over China's economic policies for their help with North Korea?
Well, I was pretty flabbergasted because in our interviews with him last year that Maggie Haberman and I did, he didn't show a huge amount of interest in the North Korea problem other than to say the Chinese would solve it. He's, as you noted, been disabused of that notion in that little seminar that Xi Jinping gave him on the brief history of China-North Korea relations. Look, there's always been some trade-off done between economic issues and security issues, but usually you're not that frontal about it. And since he got elected in large part by a vow to cure the China trade problem, I do wonder whether there are some workers around America saying, I don't remember him saying anything about swapping that out for cooperation on North Korea.
So, listeners, that's one of the things you can call on the program this morning. If you voted for Trump partly based on his wanting to get tough on China because of China's effects on American manufacturing And now he tweets, as of yesterday, why would I label China a currency manipulator when they're helping us on North Korea? Do you feel betrayed by this? 212-433-WNYC or anything else as we talk about the North Korea and Syria and national security situation generally with David Sanger, national security correspondent for the New York Times. 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. And just a few days ago, David, you wrote an article headlined, China warns of storm clouds gathering in U.S.-North Korea standoff, and you called China's comments unusually blunt. What did they say, and how might it have played into the national security for currency leniency equation?
Well, what they have done is repeatedly warned that the United States is inflaming a situation with North Korea. Rarely do they step out and publicly say that the North Koreans are inflaming the situation by moving ahead with both advanced missiles, including an ICBM that is ultimately designed to reach the American shores, or with their work on the nuclear program. Look, there is a large, there's the biggest game, although the most serious and deadly serious one, underway here. The Chinese interests are clear. They want the status quo. They want the United States to engage in another set of the six-party talks, which were the negotiations with North Korea and four other nations. And they want that to resume as a way of basically freezing things in place and not creating any trouble, because they know that if the United States and North Korea end up getting into it, instability in North Korea will ultimately result in a reunification of the Korean Peninsula on South Korean terms, and that will put South Korea, an American ally, right up on their border. So that's their interest. President Obama has, before he left office, had a policy of strategic patience, which was read by everybody as, we sit back and ignore these guys. In fact, as Bill Broad and I reported more than a month ago, Mr. Obama started up a secret cyber and electronic warfare program against the North Korean missile launches that may help explain, we're not certain, why they've had so many failures. And so he was, it was not like he was sitting there doing nothing. So the only thing that's really changed here is that Donald Trump has, rightly in my mind, said, we can't kick this problem down the road anymore.
Is China helping us with the North Korea problem in some kind of new way? Is Trump at least telling the truth about that?
It's a little too early for us to tell. There are some things you can look for that will tell you if that's happening. The first is there a crackdown on the sort of second-tier banks in China that basically make their living doing business with North Korea? If you see that crackdown, you'll know they're doing something. If the North Koreans act out and suddenly the Chinese declare that that oil pipeline that runs between China to North Korea is in for some long overdue repairs and may have to be shut down for 6 months or a year, then you'll know the Chinese are doing something different. If you begin to see North Korean ships boarded either by the Chinese, the United States, or an international group and inspected for the shipments of illicit weapons, then you'll know something has changed.
Let's take a call. Carl in Hohokus. You're on WNYC. Hi, Carl.
Hey, Brian. Thanks so much for taking my call. I just wanted to ask Mr. Sanger, there in the David Ignatius article in The Atlantic, I think from about 2 years ago, he basically said that if you go the route of regime change in Syria, you have to do it in a way that backs up.
Sorry, are you talking about Syria or are you talking about North Korea?
Sorry, I'm talking about Syria.
Okay.
If you go the route of regime change in Syria, you have to do it in a way that backs a moderate coalition or group to prevent the creation of a power vacuum and the proliferation of more either the Islamic State or other people like that. How likely do you see that as being possible in Syria, considering how wary I think people are of getting involved in anything like that considering what happened in Iraq and Afghanistan.
All right. So rotating to Syria, which I was going to get to anyway, but a little earlier than I was going to get to it. But, David, what about that?
No, Carl, it's a very good question, and we can apply the same principles to North Korea in a moment. So in the Syria case, David Ignatius is exactly right. The reason that both the Obama administration and now the Trump administration have been extremely cautious about doing anything that would oust Assad from office is the fear of the power vacuum and the split up of the country that would follow. And clearly, the opposition, as dispirited and disorganized as they are, is in no position to go replace him. And clearly, the Russians and the Iranians have positioned themselves so that they are much more likely to pick Assad's successor, if and when he goes, than we are. If you had the country break up, you would end up very much in a Libya-like situation, where you're seeing different parts of the country under control of different groups. And if we've learned anything in the post-9/11 era, it's not that a vacuum allows Islamic extremist groups to find a haven. It's that a vacuum definitely will allow an Islamic extremist group in that region to find a haven. So it's almost a certainty. So that then takes you to the question of what do you do here? And the answer is you don't really push Assad out until you've got a vision of where this is going to go. And that's what John Kerry was trying to do with his whole negotiation process that lasted 18 months and unfortunately got almost nowhere at the end of the Obama administration. I was with Secretary Tillerson in Moscow last week. And one of the more interesting moments came when Sergei Lavrov, counterpart, the Russian foreign minister, in front of a whole group of us at a news conference, offered him about a 10 or 15 minute lesson about all the regime change efforts the United States has made over the years that have gone wrong, including the two that you named.
Carl, thank you very much. Let's go to Richard in Manhattan. Richard, you're on WNYC. Hello.
To address North Korea, I do not feel, first let me explain that I voted for Bernie Sanders. I've been a lifelong Democrat, but when I felt that Hillary Clinton obtained the nomination in an inappropriate way, I then voted for Trump in the general election. And I do not feel betrayed that he changes his position on China being a currency manipulator for this reason. It is correct to reassess his own position due to new facts on the ground. When he was campaigning, North Korea had not ratcheted up its nuclear testing and missile technology development the way it does now. And I feel it's a good sign that he is not so intractable, that he will not change his view and now agrees to work with China, seeing the North Korea as a more of an existential threat. So I feel it's correct for him to put in a second position the issue of China's currency in order to address the more important issue of North Korea's nuclear power.
If you were a Bernie Sanders supporter originally, then you were kind of probably an economic nationalist in a way yourself. And so when you look at the combination of Trump trading away currency manipulation status for North Korea help, at least that's the way he put it in his tweet yesterday, and combine that with the nationalists' disdain for spending a lot of U.S. money on overseas military adventures, including propping up human rights in other countries, and then suddenly we're getting involved in Syria and spending a lot of money on that and focusing the U.S. on, you know, global concerns. Does that make you question at all whether Trump is the guy with the priorities you thought he had?
Well, I don't necessarily feel that Trump has a good enough education to have understood all these priorities before he won the office. But I feel that now he is starting to adapt to these.
Whoops. I guess the phone's going away, but we get the point. Richard, thank you very much. 212-433-WNYC. For anybody else, 212-433-9692, as we talk to New York Times national security correspondent David Sanger. David, before we rotate off this point, you're a national security correspondent, not an economics one, but there are experts who...
I was the international economics correspondent for the Times for many years.
Oh, good. Then I can cite the experts who say China stopped manipulating its currency in ways considered unfair to U.S. manufacturing years ago. And Trump was lying about that on the campaign trail all along and needed to find some excuse for backing off actually labeling them once he was elected because it wasn't true.
Well, Brian, let me pick up two elements of what Richard said in his call there before it
Please.
Dropped off. First, on the currency manipulation, at least for the past year, and some would argue significantly longer, they have not been manipulating it. In fact, if anything, they've gone in the other direction. So he did need to find a way out. The easy way out would have been able to say, they heard me on the campaign trail and they stopped doing it. And even though that wouldn't have necessarily been true, because it stopped before he was actively campaigning on the issue, it would have been closer to true than this. On the question of having a president be able to change his views, I think that's always true as events on the ground change. But the fact of the matter is, and here's where I would disagree with our caller, is that it's not as if the North Koreans have just started acting out in the increase in their testing regimes,
hardly,
both missile and nuclear. That big drive up was 2013. And that's what I was trying to get Mr. Trump to address when we were interviewing him. I don't think he was fully aware of those at the time, and maybe there are many other people who weren't either. But anybody who thinks this is a new problem just wasn't reading those headlines.
Vice President Pence is in South Korea right now. How is that related?
Well, he had planned to take this trip earlier, and in part he had planned to go do a big Asia tour because the president hasn't. There have been three now. Secretary Mattis, Secretary of Defense, went first to South Korea. Then Secretary Tillerson did about 3 or 4 weeks ago. I was with him on that trip. And now Vice President Pence has gone. So there's been an effort to have sort of a steady state of reassurance to the South Koreans and also a steady state of trying to bolster them so that as they go through this transition, their president was just impeached, it seems very likely a fairly liberal replacement will come in, that they don't walk back from the installation of the THAAD anti-missile system. And that's a lot of what he's there for.
Peter in Westchester, you're on WNYC with David Sanger. Hi, Peter.
Hi, good morning. How you doing?
Good.
I guess my question is, you know, when Tillerson said the people needed to decide on Syria, then we had the chemical attacks on the people of Syria. Recently, there was a Russian ship spotted off of the coast of Connecticut, and there's been a tremendous uptick in the rhetoric and public displays in North Korea with the parades. So how much of this is, do you think, is attributable to them testing Trump in the administration based on the complete lack of experience Trump and most of his executive branch, the cabinet members, have in relation to foreign policy experience and, you know, mm-hmm. any experience in government?
Good question, Peter. Thank you. David, do you know what he's talking about when he says a Russian
yeah.
ship off the coast of Connecticut?
There's a Russian spy ship trawler that is frequently off of the United States, so usually it's further south, down off of Virginia, and it went up as far north as Connecticut, which, of course, is where our big submarine base is there near Groton. People have been tracking it. There's nothing particularly new about that being there. The question of testing is an important one because it happens any time a new president comes in, and that's why new presidents are always advised to be somewhat more aggressive in their first year to sort of show that they won't be pushed around. And I think you're certainly seeing President Trump take that advice to heart. Some of his critics would argue that he's taken it too much to heart. Although I have to say, in my own experience in covering these things, I think in both the Syria case and in the North Korea case, he's been fairly moderate. I mean, the strike in Syria, you know, you have to remember that when President Obama declared that that he had gotten all of the declared chemical weapon stocks out of Syria, he said outright, if we see evidence of continued use of of chemical weapons, we're going to go deal with it in a fairly strong way. And I think that it was pretty incumbent on the president, whether it was whether this happened in Obama's time or whether it happened in Trump's time, to make good on that threat. So, and he did one limited strike right against the base at which these took off. So it was a fairly proportional, some would say almost pinprick strike. In the case of North Korea, he's moved a carrier group up off the coast. Well, we've done that before. President Obama used to send B-52s over the DMZ area just south of the dividing line between the two countries, as a reminder. So far, we have not seen, I don't think, excessive military action.
Who was it who called the North Korea problem the Cuban Missile Crisis in slow motion, leading to that headline on your article today?
It was my friend Rob Litwack, who's a scholar at the Woodrow Wilson Center in Washington. That's the center that is set up as a sort of living memorial to Wilson. It's an interesting analogy. I teach a course on national security with Graham Allison, who had taught me years ago, and we use the Cuban Missile Crisis analogy in the context of North Korea and have for many years, because in its similarities and its differences, it's very telling. In the Cuban Missile Crisis in 1962, the missiles were right in our neighborhood. Obviously, they were going into place in Cuba. There was a huge intelligence failure. It turned out, although we only learned this 50 or 60 years later, that there were already nuclear weapons that we didn't know about on Cuba. So we had this whole confrontation to keep Cuba from getting them, and it turned out the Soviets had already put some there. And there were lessons about the risks you take of miscommunication when you are dealing with an unpredictable leader. Khrushchev in the case of Russia, though I would argue he was a lot more predictable than Kim Jong-un is in this case.
Danny in Bell Harbor, you're on WNYC. Hi, Danny.
Hi, Brian. Happy Passover. I'm sorry, guys. After this first 100 days, I feel like I've been beat up. I just got one thing to say. I hope the Trump supporters enjoy their snake oil.
Okay, Danny, thank you very much. As people learn how much Trump can change with the tides, and whether that's flexibility in the face of reality, as our earlier caller said, or whether it's just trading this snake oil for that snake oil in the face of overwhelming ignorance, which might have been Danny's next line. You can laugh or you can cry. You can laugh or you can cry. 212-433-WNYC, 433-9692. Another of these flips by Trump is that during the campaign, Russia was good and China was bad. Now China is good and Russia is bad. Very convenient when you're being investigated by the FBI for collusion with Russia to get you elected. But you wrote an article called Striking at Assad Carries Opportunities and Risks for Trump. And your first risk was if his gambit with Vladimir Putin fails. What's the gambit?
Well, the gambit with Putin here is to try to push him back some on Syria and on the range of other things that the Russians are doing. And you have to you can argue that both the Russians and the Chinese have acted in ways contrary to our interests in the past few years, the Chinese in the South China Sea and in a variety of trade arenas, but the Russians in working on manipulating our election, European elections, intimidating former Soviet states, doing military exercises meant to go intimidate a lot of the NATO states. The list goes on and it's longer. And frankly, I think that Mr. Trump, probably with the guidance of the few in his administration who do have fairly long foreign policy experience, which includes H.R. McMaster, his national security advisor, and General Mattis, his defense secretary, is sort of edging back to something that looks like a more traditional foreign policy. Look, China is a rising power that we're going to have to learn how to deal with and, frankly, to accommodate, because they're going to end up taking some of our power space over the next 100 years. Russia is a declining power. one in which you wouldn't necessarily want to be investing because their economy is slightly larger than Sweden's, and we're dealing with them as a serious regional power because of their size, population, and the fact that they still have a large number of nuclear weapons. But if you looked at this over time and you just looked at it separated from the politics, you'd think to yourself, you want to invest a lot more in the China relationship over the next few years than you probably want to invest in the future of the Russia relationship. That doesn't mean you want to have a bad relationship with China, with Russia. Of course you don't. But it does suggest that our economic future is more tied with China.
Mark in Bushwick, you're on WNYC. Hi, Mark.
Yes. To follow up on your situation regarding investing in China, and given that Trump is known to be very transactional, do you think he's in the process of giving China, you know, some kind of political and or economic concessions, such as, okay, help me out here with North Korea, and I will ignore the situation in the South China Seas, or I will, you know, to some extent, take your path or your view regarding Taiwan?
Well, follow the tweets. You know, he has said repeatedly, as you correctly point out, he is highly transactional. He said repeatedly that everything's on the table, the Taiwan relationship, although in order to even have a first conversation with President Xi of China, he had to agree to reaffirm the One China policy. We haven't heard from him very much on the South China Sea, and I'm sure that he's got defense advisors around him saying, look, the South China Sea is a serious issue and we have to go deal with it, but it's not existential to us. Whereas North Korea could be if they ever got the capability to merge a nuclear weapon and a missile that could reach the United States. So I think the concern is, could he be too transactional and trade away something that it turned out later on we were concerned about. But he wouldn't be the first president to go do that.
Jose in Queens, you're on WNYC. Hi, Jose.
Hi, good morning, gentlemen. How are you?
Good.
Now, as one who's not too up on what justice is all about and fairness, why is it we have a problem with the North Koreans having developing weapons in defense of them of their homeland, when they have not invaded anybody's country? Korea is a place that's been invaded by others. And why shouldn't they have those kind of weapons to defend themselves, and while others have it? And they must trust. They must give up what they have and trust the West, the U.S. and others, to not invade them and take them over. Why should they?
Jose, thank you. That's a fair question. In fact, David, you cite, I noticed, as a cautionary tale about past U.S. policy, the example of Libya, where we coaxed Muammar Gaddafi into giving up a nuclear program, and then we drove him out of power anyway under Obama and Hillary Clinton at the first opportunity during the Arab Spring.
That's right. And that lesson is the one that has really resonated with the North Koreans. If you go back and you read their literature, you read their commentary, that's their warning sign. And it's fascinating because I've gone back and interviewed the people who were involved in the decision to go intervene in Libya in 2011, which is when the United States, and it's led by the European NATO partners and with some help from the Arabs, took out the air defenses and basically stopped the forces of Muammar Gaddafi from going into Benghazi. And I've asked them the question, did anybody in the course of the Situation Room debate ever ask the question, what will this look like to the North Koreans or a state like them, any other state that in the future you want to convince to give up their nuclear weapons? And I haven't found a single human being who can tell me yet who was involved in that, that discussion ever took place.
And in fairness to Trump, is his bombing of Syria and Afghanistan, whatever the downsides might be in other ways, having some deterrent effect on North Korea in a way that Obama policy did not?
It may well be. We know only that President Trump said that he was not consulted that Mick Nicholson, who was the American commander in Afghanistan, made the decision by himself to drop the that weapon in Afghanistan. Now, that's not a weapon that would help you against the North Korea problem. That weapon does not help you with deep underground facilities. We have another weapon that is designed to do exactly that, and it was built for Iran and North Korea kind of problems, where you have to get it to a nuclear missile facility that's deep under a mountain. But the one that we used in Afghanistan wouldn't be useful. As a symbol that this is a president willing to take a set of risks that his predecessor wouldn't, I guess it does send some kind of message, but I'm not sure they were really thinking about that at the time.
One more call. Al in Red Hook, you're on WNYC. Hi, Al.
Yeah, hi. Thank you for taking the call. I just wanted to ask Mr. Sanger, what proof that he has that Assad used sarin gas? You make what concrete proof has the New York Times or have you offered that they actually did it? I haven't seen it yet.
And I will point out that another Times article today, you probably saw it, David, by your colleague, the media correspondent Jim Rutenberg from Moscow, is about how it's an inverse alt-right universe there. I don't know if alt-right is a fair label for this particular question, but where the Russian media, compliant to Putin in the way that Trump wishes the media here were compliant to him, keeps asking this question and keeps saying there's no proof Assad used chemical weapons in Syria. And that's what most Russians are hearing every day while we're getting these pronouncements by our intelligence community and a very strong assumption that he did.
Yes, and people should go read Jim's column. It's his media column today. We happened by pure chance to be in Moscow at the same time last week and discuss this while we were there. So the case, as in all these cases, is a circumstantial one, although I would say in this case a very strong circumstantial one. We've got pretty good evidence about where the chemical weapons were stored on this base, pretty solid evidence about the time that the planes left the base, and radar tracking to show when they were over the target area, the city that was hit or the town that was hit. And the report of symptoms began 10 to 15 minutes later. And the Russian argument that they simply hit some depot in the town that had chemical weapons there does not seem credible with the pattern of where people were affected, and we've never found any evidence of any such depot. We have found evidence of craters in the road where some of the weapons fell and the effects were felt immediately. So you may have a hard time with the American case, and I think there are some reasons to raise some questions about it, but so far we've seen no evidence that supports the Russian argument.
The Guardian newspaper, which would be no toady of American power, reported some connections of knowing that Syrian planes did take off and fly over that area at that time, and then autopsies and other reports from hospitals in Turkey, where some of the victims were taken, reported by these Turkish hospitals that there were clear signs of poison gas, symptoms and autopsies in the cases of people who died. So those would be two pieces of very strong evidence that seem to link together.
Right, and the timing is really key here. I mean, if Assad's planes didn't do this, it would be the oddest coincidence of timing on attacks that we've seen in some time.
David Sanger, national security correspondent for The New York Times. Thank you so much. This was so informative. We got so many questions from listeners who wanted you to fill them in as you heard. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Brian. We'll do it again sometime.
Yep. Brian Lehrer on WNYC. Coming up next, we're going to go live to Georgia with that very important special congressional election tomorrow that could be the first sign of voters turning away from Donald Trump. Stay with us.